I have to go upstairs and record something again, so
quiet
and do not
smash anything
and do not disturb.
Do not disturb.
Do not come into your room.
Hi, you're listening to Pandemic, a new podcast from RTE News and Current Affairs on the COVID-19 crisis. I'm Cullum O'Mungoyne, and most days of the week I'll be talking to RTE's correspondents, reporters and others to bring you news, updates and analysis you can trust. We can guarantee you a high quality of information. The sound quality, on the other hand, might vary somewhat sometimes, as correspondents and I will be recording this, in many cases, on mobile devices from home, so please do bear with us. It's Friday, May 15th, and at the time of recording this in the evening, over 304,000 people have died from COVID-19 around the world. Of those, 1,506 have died in Ireland. In this episode of RTE's podcast on the pandemic, we'll talk to former President Mary Robinson about her new podcast on the pandemic called Finding Humanity, in which she discusses the challenges facing leaders in coping with the coronavirus, but also looking at what positive change could be affected in the longer term. We'll get her thoughts on some of that, so do stay with us. Also, preparing for a situation that nobody wanted to see. RTE foreign reporter Juliette Gash speaks to UNICEF about COVID-19 reaching the Rohingya refugees. But first today,
I can confirm that it is safe to proceed with phase one of our plan to ease the COVID-19 restrictions from Monday.
We got details at a government briefing earlier about the easing of restrictions from next Monday. People will be asked not to travel further than 5 kilometres, but can meet with groups of 4 outdoors at a distance of 2 metres. The Taoiseach outlined 5 key points at that press conference earlier.
1, to go to work if your workplace is open and if you can't work from home. 2, to shop for items that you need. 3, to exercise within 5 kilometres of your home. 4, for medical reasons or to care for others. And 5, to meet friends or family outdoors in groups of no more than 4.
We also got some clarity from the Taoiseach on the issue of masks, or rather face coverings.
Just on the face coverings, so we are advising people to wear a face covering if they're using public transport or if they're in a busy enclosed space, like for example a shop, but it's not going to be a legal requirement. And there's 2 reasons for that. You know, first of all, the science around it indicates that it may be beneficial, but it's certainly no substitute for all of the other things, like washing your hands, social distancing, and respiratory etiquette. So we really need to emphasise that. It's an additional hygiene measure. It's not a substitute for social distancing and for other forms of hygiene. But also, secondly, there are some people who have allergies, for example, to face masks and face coverings and things like that, and we have to bear that in mind. And it is a face covering, and there will be lots of information made available to people, videos showing people how to make face coverings at home, when to use them, and how not to use them, and how to use them, because we think that's going to be important. When it comes to surgical masks, or when it comes to respiratory masks, while there is no shortage of them at the moment, if we had millions of people using them every day, there's a risk that it might lead to a shortage.
Yes to hardware stores reopening, no to homeware stores, but what if a store is both? Enterprise Minister Heather Humphreys took on that question, but it did recur, it must be said.
But first of all, hardware is now, you're allowed to have open. The hardware shops are allowed to open. In terms of homeware, they're not allowed to open. So it's fairly simple there. Now, I know you're saying that there are hardware shops that have homeware, but if you're predominantly a hardware shop, you can obviously stay open and sell all of the products.
Now, the reason hardware can reopen from Monday is because that's when outdoor construction reopens. But when is construction indoor and when is it outdoor? Well, seeing as outdoor can reopen from Monday, the Taoiseach offered a definition of this.
But we do appreciate that when it comes to construction sites in general, it's not as simple as just saying indoor or outdoors. You know, you start on a construction site, it's all outdoors at the start. But by the end, as the walls go up and the roof goes on, it becomes indoor. So, you know, that form of construction can continue, provided it's done safely in accordance with the guidelines. But no, wouldn't be possible for people to, you know, get their kitchen redone or something like that. That would be in a later stage.
Now, we heard in recent weeks that a large proportion of travellers through ports and airports were not filling out forms advising authorities of further movements. Now, that has been tightened up.
The position is that anyone arriving into our ports and airports will be required to quarantine for 14 days. There are some exceptions, like pilots, cabin crew, hauliers, for example, some essential workers. But for the vast majority of people arriving into Ireland, into our ports and airports, they have to fill in the form. That's going to be the law. And they're also required to quarantine for 14 days. And that will apply to people travelling from Britain. But we will treat British citizens the same as Irish citizens. So if you're an Irish citizen flying in from Birmingham or a British citizen flying in from London, you will be treated the same. So there won't be any discrimination, if you like, against British citizens. There is an exception, of course, or there are a few exceptions, but one exception is transit to and from Northern Ireland. So a lot of people travel from Northern Ireland to Britain through Dublin and vice versa, and they will be allowed to continue to transit.
And then finally, from that briefing to some longer-term issues, horse racing is set to reopen behind closed doors, if that's not a contradiction in terms, in June, and here's why.
Horse racing behind closed doors will be allowed to resume from the 8th of June, and that's just taking into account what's happening in the UK and what's happening in France, because this is a big economic sector, a lot of people employed in it, worth nearly €500 million to the economy each year. Because people won't be able to travel to race meetings, the amount of movements happening are going to be very limited. It's people travelling to and from their workplace, essentially, but won't be open to spectators, not for the foreseeable future. But it is a big economic sector, a lot of jobs, a lot of income, and we need to be aligned, or more or less aligned, with what's happening in the UK and France in that regard.
Schools are still due back in September.
Yeah, just on the schools, you know, the plan published and agreed in April says that schools will open in September, and that's what we're working towards, and there's been no change in that regard.
And finally, listener, don't rule out new taxes.
It may be possible, or maybe necessary at some point down the line. The taxes have to be increased, and I know one tax that all three parties have agreed would increase is the carbon tax. But certainly my party has taken a very strong position that we wouldn't be in favour of increasing corporation profit tax. We want to keep the 12.5% rate as it is, because more so than ever we're going to need foreign direct investment to get the economy going again and to create jobs. And we don't support an increase in income tax or USE, because more so than ever we need to support domestic demand. You know, this recession will turn into a depression if we're in a position where we get back to cutting people's pay or cutting welfare or increasing income taxes. And, you know, we've been very firm about wanting to avoid that. But it's not a blanket ruling out of any tax increases ever. That wouldn't be a credible position, I don't think.
Now, let's get more on that briefing and others from our correspondent, Orla O'Donnell, who spent her day at them. OK, Orla, we've heard a number of clips from the briefing there covering a wide range of issues. Now, one I didn't play, but it came up a number of times, was the issue of the Mater Hospital and the figures that came to light. We missed it on this podcast yesterday. The briefing happened after we recorded. So what happened about the Mater Hospital, these new cases that came to light that the authorities hadn't been informed of, and what action has been taken on foot of the authorities not hearing about it?
Yes, well, the answer, the short answer is nobody's quite fully clear about exactly what happened. Yesterday we heard there were 426 confirmed cases for yesterday, and that was quite a big jump on the kinds of figures we've been seeing every day. But Dr. Tony Houlihan said a large number of these weren't new cases. They'd been reported by one hospital in a single block. And now this afternoon we found out that hospital was the Mater, and we found out that 244 cases were involved. These go back to mid-March. So we've been trying to find out more details about what has happened and how this could have come about. What we know is that these cases relate to healthcare workers at the Mater, cases relating to healthcare workers at a hospital are notified separately to the HSC, separate from patients. They were notified first by phone, then by email, and it's done through the occupational health department of the hospital. And I suppose the main question that arises is, did this issue arise from something that the hospital did or didn't do in terms of reporting cases, or did the problem arise at a later stage? Is there a wider problem with the way the system captures the data or processes the data? Now, Tony Houlihan, when he was asked about this evening, said, in fairness, he said they just don't know yet. That's one of the issues that they're looking at. The CEO of the HSE, Paul Reid, is investigating this matter. The HSE said it didn't know. It wasn't in a position to say if the hospital did or didn't report the cases. That was something that was under review with the Ireland East Hospital Group, and the matter itself is adamant that it reported all positive COVID-19 results to the authorities on a daily basis, that it provided all the information it was required to, met all the legal requirements, that its information was correct and up to date. And it says it's working with the HSE to understand why the provided data may not have been accurately captured. And it's understood that there possibly may be an issue around the way the information is captured or inputted or processed by a central computerised infectious disease system, and particularly in relation to the staff of a hospital, and that may be the area that the problem has arisen from. The hospital says all those contacts of the cases have been traced, that has been done. The Minister for Health, when he was speaking about this earlier, said that this is one of the matters that Paul Reid is investigating, and it's up to the HSC and to its chief executive to assure government that the contact tracing has been done.
So the firmest thing that could be said in answer to all of those questions of yes, there is an investigation and we're just going to have to wait for answers.
Yes, and I suppose it fundamentally boils down to whether or not there was some kind of error on the part of the matter about reporting this data, or whether they did report it and the error arose in terms of processing the data, which would give rise to the question or to questions about whether it could arise in other hospitals, whether other hospitals have suffered from the same problem in terms of inputting data. But we just don't know yet. And the chief medical officer said he was very clear that they just haven't established that yet.
Orla, something that has come up, I think it came up in the UK first, was children who were admitted to intensive care units, not directly with COVID-19, but of inflammation disorders, that there was a suspicion related to COVID-19. And you're just straight out of a briefing this evening. So what did you hear on that?
Dr. Tony Houlihan spoke about this syndrome called paediatric inflammatory multisystem syndrome. And he spoke about the fact that the ECDC had issued a warning about this, that it had been seen in New York, a syndrome that affects children very badly. Now, he said there had been 7 children, wouldn't go as far as to say suspected cases in this country, but 7 children about whom a query had been raised as to whether this syndrome could have been part of what was going on with them in this country since the outbreak began. And he said really what he was doing was raising this as an issue for doctors and clinicians to be aware of, that when a child comes to hospital and when they're very ill, that they should consider that this could be an issue, that they should consider testing them for COVID-19, and that it could be. Nobody is quite sure whether it's caused by COVID-19 or not. There's a suggestion that it's an inflammatory reaction to the disease in children, but again, it was said at the press conference this evening that they're not sure if that is the case, but they want clinicians to be aware that it could be an issue, and that when they're looking at children who are very ill, who have high temperatures, that this could be a factor in their presentation. But they wanted to stress very strongly to parents that it's very, very rare. It's a very rare syndrome, and it's very unlikely. Children get temperatures very easily from all kinds of things, but they just want doctors to be aware of this and to be looking out for it. If they look at all the things that could be wrong with a child and they rule out lots of other things, that maybe they should consider that this could be a factor.
All right. Thanks a million, Orla.
Okay.
Now, former President Mary Robinson is no stranger to podcasting, but she and fellow former leaders collectively known as the Elders have put out a new series called Finding Humanity, starting today. It looks at challenges facing the world from COVID-19 and other issues like human rights, climate change and the need for international collective action. When the notice of the podcast landed in my email inbox earlier today, I wondered if she might be interested in talking about some of the things she covered, and she agreed to take a call.
Hello.
Hello, hi, it's Cullum O'Mungoin here.
Hello, hi.
So are you ready to begin?
Yes.
So how is the lockdown going for you?
It's changed a lot of my life, as it has for everybody. Nick and myself are here in our apartment in Dublin, and we're lucky enough to have a bit of space where we can go outside and walk around, even while we were being severely cocooned. So we can't complain. What has changed for me is not travelling as much as I was to events because I was so urgent on the climate crisis. And instead, learning new ways to communicate virtually, learning to be on Zoom and other platforms, and taking part in virtual conferences almost every day.
Any of it beneficial, do you find? Do you think meetings are tighter, more efficient, or is it a more difficult way of conducting your business?
It's certainly very busy and demanding. There are so many emails and then so many Zoom conferences or podcasts being arranged, or perhaps initially because I wanted to keep busy, I accepted too many. I'm not sure. Either way, there's a lot going on. Most of what I'm doing, you know, is rather like the podcast that the elders have launched, talking about the key issues in relation to COVID-19. A lot of the focus is on how will we emerge well, given that we also have the looming climate crisis. So we have to build back better in a very thoughtful way.
So you're launching a podcast and you're recording it with fellow elders and others. Can you tell us why the podcast and why now?
It's partly because the elders also had to rethink how we would communicate in this increasingly virtual world. I was the only elder who had done podcasts before, I think. And now Juan Manuel Santos, who did the second podcast with me, is on social media. So he probably had been involved in podcasts, but it was quite a new experience for a number of us. I've enjoyed my podcast, Mothers of Invention. I'm not sure if you know it, with Maeve Higgins.
Yes, you are the mother of pod, or the pod mother, well, so to speak.
I don't think so, but I've certainly enjoyed it. And we are going to do another series, and we're going to do it more virtually than we had done. But the Elder series is with this wonderful woman, Asami, who has the Finding Humanity platform. She has really, you know, very much been able to have exactly the right environment for the elders to be on a podcast with her, because she's very concerned about the same issues, about human rights, refugees, the impact of on African countries, for example, which I did with Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. And the final one, which hasn't yet been recorded, I will do with Gro Brundtland on multilateralism and defending multilateralism, which the elders feel is really, really important at this stage. If we had a better multilateral approach to COVID-19, we would help to resolve some of the terribly difficult issues.
That's actually a good point to start then, the issue of multilateralism. We've seen on a number of issues, but COVID-19 has been one of them, an awful lot of division, an awful lot of rowing. The World Health Organization has found itself in the middle of a row between America and China as well. There's an awful lot of politics to be navigated there, but the ground wasn't particularly fertile for multilateralism over the last couple of years anyway.
No, it hasn't been. It's very sad. And a key part of it is the fact that the current administration in the United States, led by President Trump, isn't interested in multilateralism, actually wants to undermine it in the name of something called America First. And we've seen that in a number of different ways, pulling out of the climate conference, pulling out of the Human Rights Council, many kind of difficulties, blocking appointment of the Judicial Tribunal of the World Trade Organization and so on. Now we're in a different situation where we have an acute crisis, which really, really should have the benefit of even more multilateral cooperation than ever. But other countries have taken their lead a little bit from the United States in populism, in putting their countries first, in not taking seriously the science behind either the climate issue or now the COVID issue.
Well, whatever about countries who have the resources or the wherewithal to improve their own health services, or even if you were to put it in a negative way, to be selfish about the resources they have themselves and to look after themselves, there is a large cohort of countries that don't have that ability, that will require an awful lot of multilateralism to get to grips if COVID-19 is to be contained on a global level. One thinks of Africa, or what would be broadly known as the Global South. Africa is very much an unknown. So is that an area you touch on in the podcast, or do you have any particular thoughts on that yourself, seeing as you've done work there and has been an area of your concern of yours over the years?
Yes, that's the third podcast which will be published, where I focused with Ellen Johnson Sirleaf on two issues, as it happened, on Africa. And of course, she dealt with the Ebola crisis as president of Liberia. So she has a lot of really good expertise to bring to bear from a leadership position. And we also talked about the role of women in coping with the climate, the COVID crisis, which is also quite interesting, that women-led countries like Merkel in Germany, the prime ministers of Norway, Denmark, Finland, Iceland, have all coped better. Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand, the president of Taiwan, all of these countries have taken the science seriously and taken tough decisions that have helped their people to address coping strictly initially and then being able to come out of the crisis sooner. But on Africa, we had a very interesting discussion, and Ellen was really very knowledgeable. But we also recognize that countries need support to strengthen their health systems. And now 8 billion has been approved for the WHO and for in a donor conference recently for the WHO for vaccines and for therapeutics. But that's a small part of the real problem. What we really need is the rich countries to come together with major funding for support for vaccines. There are a number of vaccine trials taking place now, we know that. But until we get the vaccine and have it available and have it rolled out universally, not for the rich countries, and then think about the poor countries later, because otherwise we won't be able to solve this problem, because we will have countries in Africa and other parts of the world suffering, and then a resurgence in the rich parts of the world if we don't tackle this problem universally with universal access.
What about the issue of debt relief? Because it has been raised as a prospect. There was a recent discussion in the London School of Economics between Gordon Brown, Larry Summers and others that unless there was debt relief and unless actually China cooperated in debt relief, because quite a lot of countries in Africa are indebted to China, that people may not see the incentive of investment unless they know it's going directly towards public health, and countries' capacity to invest in public health is going to be dictated to by their balance of payments.
Yes, I've been in recent discussion on telephone and by email with Gordon Brown, who had this really very good initiative of the letter to the G20, which the elders, all of us, supported him in and signed. And that called for, very substantial debt relief. In many ways, the debt relief has to be linked to countries implementing the sustainable development goals, which were agreed in a better time for multilateralism in 2015, in September 2015, before the Paris Climate Agreement. It was remarkable that you could have 193 countries agree an agenda with the 17 sustainable development goals, which was full of language of human rights and gender equality and leaving no one behind. That was the top point, perhaps, of multilateralism before, in particular, the change of administration in the United States. And things went very bumpy after that. I am very supportive, personally, of what Gordon Brown has been seeking to do in persuading the G20. They have not yet made sufficiently concrete decisions. There will be a finance minister's G20 meeting, I think it's on the 19th of May, and the leaders' meeting following that. And we are very focused on trying to persuade them to address the need for a concerted multilateral approach.
And do you detect the same amount of urgency about Africa? The figures have been relatively low at the moment, and there's been some speculation that perhaps it wouldn't be hit as hard. But it also may be the case that what exists at the moment is a lull, and there is sufficient time there to invest and invest early. What are your fears personally, having talked to your fellow elders and having seen crises break out in the Great Lakes regions and other areas over the years? What are your fears at the moment for Africa in particular?
Well, we certainly had a good discussion. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf was quite open to the fact that we still don't quite know. Africa, the African countries have very young populations, spend a lot of time out of doors, but at the same time find it very difficult to socially distance. And so, you know, there certainly have been deaths and outbreaks. I'm relatively familiar with the figures in South Africa itself, where there's been quite a severe lockdown, but also, you know, some deaths which are being addressed and coped with. They have coped with the HIV issue. They've coped with Ebola in certain parts of Africa, like Liberia and Sierra Leone. So there is some knowledge of how to do it. And as yet, it hasn't been as bad, let's put it that way, in African countries as we had feared. But still, with weak health systems and weak tracking systems, we don't really know whether it will get worse or maybe in some cases is worse than we think.
There is perhaps a more optimistic, at least the description of one of the podcasts you've recorded with Juan Manuel Santos, it seems to be a more optimistic in tone. It talks about peace building, climate change and lessons for the post-COVID-19 world. It seems at least a brighter theme. What do you cover there?
Juan Manuel Santos, the former president of Colombia, is a wonderful man. I really got to know him very well and to hugely respect how he led his country. Things have changed not for the better in his country, Colombia, since he stepped down, ended his term. But he really deserved that Nobel Peace Prize, which he got. It was just terrible to see the deaths from the conflict with the FARC. So he linked the peace plan with the environment. And that's what he spoke about so well on the podcast. He's got a great sense of humanity. But, there's no doubt that COVID-19 basically exacerbates all of the inequalities in our world before that, including the inequalities of being locked in an abusive household here in Ireland or elsewhere with domestic violence. You know, I've just done a support for Women's Aid concert coming up because I know that there is more domestic violence. I mean, there are so many other issues. Child marriage is on the increase. Workers who work for food, basically, in the informal sector, they work because that will pay for the food for the family on that day. If they don't work, where's the food? We're going to have an increasing food crisis. That may be part of what we will see, particularly in Africa and parts of South Asia, as a looming part of the aggravation, exacerbation of the COVID crisis.
So what needs to be looked at? You, as you say, that particular episode looks at the post-COVID-19 world, but what are the things that could be gotten to grips with structurally as people think about how the disease might be tackled? What themes do you think could be and need to be gotten to grips with that would deal with, in terms of a knock-on effect, with a lot of the other issues you're exploring?
Well, the elders haven't, in our current series of podcasts, particularly focused on the building back better recovery from both COVID-19 and from the climate crisis. But I have talked on other forums, two of them yesterday, in fact, about the need to, as I say, build back better, in particular, the importance of the European Green Deal, of making sure that we recognise the need for an acceleration towards supporting clean energy, supporting green jobs, supporting insulating of housing and buildings, for example, which will provide lots of jobs. The fact that in many ways I was a little bit downhearted last January as we faced into 2020, where I couldn't see the ambition of countries to do what we needed to do to address the climate crisis, which scientists have told us we had to address urgently because we had to reduce by 45% global carbon emissions by 2030, and that was only 10 years away. Yet there was no ambition. I wouldn't have wished COVID-19 on anyone because it is terrible and destructive, and so many lives have been lost. So many people have had terrible health problems, but also livelihoods worries, mental health problems. Every country is facing them. We're facing them here in Ireland. But actually, we're also in a new place, and it's a better place from which to think how we will move forward in a way that's more in tune with nature. We're all noticing, you know, the birds singing, the air being cleaner, even in Dublin. It's much, much cleaner in countries like New Delhi, where they were choked, or in Beijing. Much more deaths took place from air pollution than have taken place so far from COVID-19. So these are things that we can at least think about. And I have to say, I think I've thought about enough of them on this podcast.
All right. OK, well, that's, I suppose, a suitably optimistic note to leave it on. Thanks very much.
OK, thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
OK, bye.
Since 2017, hundreds of thousands of Muslim Rohingya have fled Myanmar in the face of violence by the country's military and militias, which the UN is now investigating as possible genocide. Many ended up in Cox's Bazar, an area of nearby Bangladesh. 850,000 refugees, of whom half are children, now live there in what's the most densely populated refugee camp in the world. UNICEF says 40,000 people live there per square kilometre, but because of COVID-19, 80% less NGO staff are travelling to the field on a daily basis. Monsoon rains are just about to start, and also cyclone season is beginning, and the area has seen extensive flooding before. And on top of all of this, the first case of COVID-19 has been confirmed in the camp. RTE foreign reporter Juliet Gash has been speaking to UNICEF's Karen Reedy, who's from Kilkenny, but is now in Cox's Bazar. And Juliet asked her about the possibilities for hand washing and social distancing in such cramped and crowded conditions.
So I think that's a major challenge when it comes to COVID-19, because we have physical distancing measures are in place in certain areas in the camps at different centres. There's mandatory hand washing before you enter a health facility or a nutrition facility. But the challenge is also at the household level, because sometimes you have 10 to 12 people who are sharing one shelter. And in terms of people's latrine and bathing cubicles, those are shared among the communities. So you would have one latrine serving 20 people. So that definitely provides a challenge when it comes to disease transmission. And those areas are currently being disinfected on a regular basis.
We've now heard that at least one refugee has tested positive for COVID-19. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So yesterday we found out that the first case has been confirmed in the refugee camps. That person is now being treated in an isolation centre. There's a rapid investigation team has been activated, and they're currently conducting the contact tracing and testing of those contacts where appropriate. So it's a very worrying development. It's something that we've anticipated and been preparing for quite some time. But at the same time, you know, it really shows that the clock is now starting to tick in terms of how much time we have to really scale up the preparation efforts, strengthen the health facilities, increase the hygiene promotion activities in the camps. And one really important aspect is also communicating with the Rohingya community themselves around COVID-19 so that they understand the symptoms, what is quarantine, what to do when they feel sick, because we know that there's a lot of fear and there's a lot of rumors circulating in the camps as well. So that's a really, really key part of our response.
Is it likely, given how busy and crowded the camp is, that this individual would have come into contact with many other people?
It's quite likely. I don't know further details on the individual's case yet, but in the camps there's very regular communication. People are social. There are physical distancing measures in place right now, but it's very hard to implement when people live in such crowded conditions. The shelters are more or less 50 centimeters apart from each other, so it's very, very difficult.
I understand that the camp itself has been sort of on lockdown, but obviously movement within still happens. It's impossible to stop.
Yes, that's correct. The measures were maybe more stringent before, but you know, as time wears on and people are under lockdown for several weeks, people also, you know, feel the need to go outside. It's extremely hot at the moment. It's 34 degrees. People's shelters are basically plastic sheeting and bamboo tarpaulin. So you can imagine it's extremely hot inside those shelters. So people do need to take some air at some point of the day. But of course, now that the first case has been confirmed, that may change. People may be much more compliant when it comes to staying indoors because, you know, there's a very real fear inside the camps.
So what's UNICEF's first priority now?
I think one of the biggest priorities for us at the moment is increasing the health facility capacity in Cox Bazar district. We're currently building 240 beds to isolate and treat patients of COVID-19 from both the refugee population and the Bangladeshi population. So that's a huge operation. Also, other humanitarian partners are doing the same. So there's 1,900 beds will be created, especially in Cox Bazar district, to help cater for the needs due to COVID-19. So that's a very important aspect that we're working on right now. We do have challenges within that in terms of getting all the supplies in place, getting the human resources. We need more doctors, we need more nurses, but people are working around the clock to try to make sure that all the required supplies and medicines are in place for when the facility opens.
So Karen, tell me a little bit more about the wider impact of something like this when you have to focus all your resources onto COVID-19, perhaps at the expense of other programmes.
I think we're quite concerned about the impact and particularly the longer term impact, you know, if we try to look a few months down the line where we might be, because we've seen already interruptions to the immunization programs. We see less people coming to the health centers for regular health care because they're afraid of catching the virus. Nutrition services have been adjusted so that we can, you know, do more work remotely, that we can rely more on the Rohingya refugees themselves to lead some of the services that we're providing in the camps. A few months down the line, we may be seeing things like food shortages, and that may be impacting children in ways that we can't foresee fully right now. We've also seen cases in many other countries of gender-based violence increasing. In Cox Bazar, it's a very poor district in Bangladesh to begin with. So not just in the camps, but also among the host communities here, people have less access to cash. I'm sure there are a lot of increased frustrations and tensions in people's households. So, you know, we're very concerned also with the fact that our services have been scaled back. We want to be in a position to respond to where those critical needs really are.
And that's all for this episode of Pandemic. We're back on Monday with more. In the meantime, do get in contact with suggestions or questions by email to colm.omongain@rte.ie. That's colm.omongain@rte.ie. And thanks to anyone who's already gotten in touch. You can also contact me on Twitter at colmomongain. Do subscribe through your usual podcast platform to get this regularly. Reviews are welcome. Nice reviews are even more welcome. But until Monday, have a good weekend. Slán, keep safe.